dark clothes, sort of grungy. But she picked out a feminine white coat with a fur collar because she thought that's what girls were supposed to wear, then relegated the coat to the closet when she realized it wasn't. Peggy could see that Marie wasn't happy at school. It was pretty cliquey, with all the cliches, the cheerleaders and the jocks. Marie was more of an artist type, into drawing and music, be it Christian, rock, or country. Together, Peggy and Marie found an alternative school that was a better fit, and that's when things clicked. Through friends, Marie met Jordan, a high school student who worked at a McDonald's. We ended up meeting at a grocery store and then walking around the schoolyard, you know, after hours or something like that, Jordan says of the first time they were alone. They started as friends and, in time, became boyfriend and girlfriend. To Jordan, Marie came off as happy and easygoing, no matter her past. She was just a nice person to have around. You never had to worry about sharing your emotions with her. She would never say anything to hurt you. Among her friends and things like that, she was not an attention seeker. She never did anything openly outgoing or off-the-wall crazy. That Jordan would see Marie so differently from Peggy doesn't necessarily surprise. Peggy saw Marie wanting attention. Jordan saw her avoiding it. Teens can be one person with their friends, another with their parents. But to Marie, there was something more to this disconnect, something she would pick up on as the years passed. "People read me different than I see myself," she says. Marie saw herself as friendly, not flirtatious, as outgoing, not dramatic. Marie figures her happiest years were when she was 16 and 17, and the happiest day may have been one spent with her best friend, another high school student who was teaching Marie the fine points of photography. "I would spend hours at the beach watching the sunset go down, and that was one of my favorite things," Marie says. "There was a particular photo that I really liked that she took. We went to the ocean. It was like 7 o'clock at night. I don't know what we were thinking. I got in there, and I jumped out and swung my hair back." Her friend captured the moment. Afterward, she did touch-up, darkening parts of the picture. Marie looked like a mermaid emerging from the surf in the glory of the setting sun. Marie posted the photo on MySpace and preserved it in an online album on Photo Bucket. When Marie was a senior, she opted to quit school and study for her general equivalency diploma. That final year with Peggy was marked by tension, the kind familiar to teens and parents just about everywhere. Marie pushed, staying out late. Peggy pushed back, insisting that rules be followed. "You can't do that," Peggy would say. "You can't tell me what to do," Marie would answer. To Shannon, it was just one of those rebellious stages that can accompany the approach of adulthood. Wanting to do what she wanted to do, not wanting to follow the rules. She experimented with different ways to dress, which paths she was going to go down. Not unlike a lot of teenagers. Started to smoke, those kinds of things. In the spring of 2008, Marie turned 18. She could have stayed with Peggy, provided she abided by Peggy's rules. But Marie wanted to set out on her own. Peggy, searching online, discovered Project Ladder, a pilot program launched the year before. Funded mostly by a state grant, the program sought to reduce homelessness by helping young adults land stable jobs so they could afford a place to live. Program members would learn self-sufficiency and financial literacy. Private landlords who housed program members would receive guaranteed rent subsidies and large security deposits. Project Ladder had only 15 slots for teens transitioning out of foster care, but Marie secured one. she moved into an apartment complex in Linwood, allowing her to stay close to Peggy. In the 1920s, decades before it incorporated and adopted its name, Linwood was known for poultry, producing enough eggs in one year that laid end to end, they would stretch from New York to San Francisco. These days, people around Seattle know Linwood mostly as a shopping mecca. The main attraction is the Alderwood Mall and its 165 shops, from Abercrombie & Fitch to Zumiez. Marie's apartment complex advertised views of the Cascades and proximity to the mall, just a few blocks away. Marie thought that when she had her feet under her, she'd like to go to college and study photography. She used a Nikon digital to shoot animals, insects, and most of all, landscapes. She'd go to a beach dotted with driftwood and shoot dog prints in the sand, or the sun on the sound, or beyond the waves, the snow-capped peaks of the Olympics. But for now, she settled into retail, landing her first job at Costco, the warehouse club known for generous wages and benefits. Marie offered food samples to customers. 6 hours on her feet didn't bother her. She enjoyed chatting with people, free from pressure to sell. Working also let her make friends outside the foster care system. So Marie had an apartment, an income, and her GED. She had a support system in Project Ladder. She had Peggy nearby. After all she had endured, abuse, instability, hunger, she had made it through. Her greatest goal was a simple one, and it was there, right in front of her. I just wanted to be normal. When I moved out from being in foster care, I wanted to be one of those normal kids who had a normal job, a place to live. Just wanted to live my life, try to be as happy as possible. She didn't want to let the bad things in her past affect the way she was now. After Marie finished cleaning her apartment, she went to church with Jordan. They had dated for more than a year, but 2 months ago went back to being just friends. Jordan had begun studying the Jehovah's Witnesses religion, which condemns premarital sex. Jordan feared being a hypocrite if he and Marie kept dating. Still, their friendship was closer than most. They both had insomnia and would keep each other company over the phone, chatting late into the night. They even talked of getting married one day. In the evening, Marie visited Ashley, a friend she had made when both were studying for their GEDs. Marie didn't yet have her driver's license, just a learner's permit, so she snagged a ride home from Ashley's mom. When she arrived home, she realized she had left her keys behind. She was always forgetting her keys or her phone. So it was back to Ashley's, then home again. Before tucking in, Marie visited for a few minutes with her upstairs neighbor, Natalie, a fellow 18-year-old in Project Ladder. Natalie lived directly above Marie in their three-story building, where each apartment was accessible from the outside. By the time Marie went back downstairs, it was after 9 o'clock. She walked inside, locked her front door, and settled in for the night. Her phone rang at 9:49 p.m. It was Jordan. In days to come, he would check his call history to provide police with the precise time. Marie and Jordan talked for about 15 minutes. Afterward, Marie strummed one of her guitars for a bit before getting into bed. At 12:30 a.m., Jordan called again. This time, the two stayed on the phone for hours. It was now Monday, August 11th, and Marie and Jordan talked until 4:30, the call ending only when the battery on Jordan's phone died. At 4:58 a.m., Jordan called again. Marie and Jordan talked until 6:15. Then Marie went to sleep. Chapter 4, A Violent Alchemy, August 10th, 2010, Westminster, Colorado. Early one morning in August, an older woman sat hunched on a bed in room 24 of the emergency ward of St. Anthony North in suburban Denver. She was eating yogurt and sipping water from a clear plastic bottle. Her hair was dyed red, the color fading. She wore a white, long-sleeved hoodie with a rainbow splashed across its front. Her thin legs stuck out from a pair of blue shorts. At 8:04 a.m., there was a knock, and a woman with long blonde hair and wide blue eyes entered the room. She wore a blue polo shirt and khaki pants with a police badge resting on her hip. She glanced at the woman on the bed. She thought the older woman looked almost like a lost child, her eyes red, her cheeks streaked. She knelt and introduced herself. Her name was Detective Edna Hendershot. "I know that something terrible has happened to you," she told the woman. "I'm here to find out about it." Sarah had already told her story to the neighbors she did not know, standing in the cool air outside her apartment in the light of early morning. She had already told the young officer who drove her to the hospital in his squad car. She had already told the other woman sitting quietly with her in the hospital room, a victim's advocate the police had assigned to her for support. She summoned herself. She would tell her story again. Sarah had moved into a new apartment at the beginning of the month. After days of sorting and storing, of figuring where to put the couch and how to decorate her bedroom, of unpacking boxes of clothes and shoes and kitchen utensils, she decided to rest. She spent Monday morning dozing by the pool. She walked a trail that circled the apartment buildings. That evening, she had read her Bible in her apartment. At around midnight, she changed into her nightgown and fell asleep to the sound of an oscillating fan. At around 3:30, she was startled awake. A heavy weight pressed into her back, pushing her hard into the bed. It was a man, straddling her with his legs. He had pinned her arms to her side. She cried out, a sound that seemed to die in her throat. "Just be quiet," the man said. "I won't hurt you if you do everything I say, but I do have a gun and can use it if I have to." The man wore a white T-shirt and sweatpants, Sarah told Hendershot. A black mask covered his face. He bound her hands behind her and stripped off her underwear. He ordered her onto the bed. He instructed her to pose. He took pictures with a camera. If she didn't do it right, he would correct her. "If you don't do what I say, then these pictures are going to be all over the internet. Everyone will see them," he told her. For 3 hours, he forced Sarah to submit. He would rape her, then rest, take pictures, then rest. Sarah called them sessions. She could remember 9 of them. She would tell him that he was hurting her. "Just relax," he'd say. At one point, Sarah told Hendershot, she pleaded with the rapist to stop. "I'm not a bad person," she told him.
"No, you're not a bad person," he answered, "but you left your window open."
When he finished with her, the dawn light was creeping into her jumbled apartment. He set to work eradicating evidence. He cleaned Sarah's body with moist towelettes. He ordered her to brush her teeth and her tongue. He had scooped up some of her bedding.
"I'm not leaving any evidence here for the police to find, so I'll have to take some things with me," he told her.
He ordered Sarah into the bathroom. He told her to wash for 20 minutes. Sarah wanted to know when the time was up. She asked him to get her a timer.
"Where is it?" he asked.
"There, on the kitchen counter," she told him. It was a white sunbeam.
He cranked the dial to 20 minutes and placed it on the counter by the bathroom sink. Then he closed the door and left. She stood in the shower, the water streaming down her body. She listened to each of the 1,200 seconds tick off, the timer whirring like a cicada in the summer. When it rang at last, she stepped from the shower. She dried herself off, and she began to catalog the damage. The rapist had stolen a green satin pillow from the bed, the one given to her by her mother as a keepsake. He had taken $200 from a safe beneath her bed. He had stolen a camera. He had changed her life forever. It was not an easy story to tell. Sarah sobbed throughout the interview. The advocate comforted her. Hendershot comforted her. After 30 minutes, Hendershot decided Sarah had had enough. As she stood, Hendershot told Sarah that a nurse was going to examine her. Perhaps, she said, the rapist had not succeeded in covering his tracks. Perhaps some of his DNA remained inside her. I can only hope, Sarah replied. Driving to Sarah's apartment complex, Hendershot ticked off the tasks in her head. 16 years of police work had burned a crime scene checklist into her. She needed patrol officers to canvass neighbors and search dumpsters. She needed a criminalist to search the apartment and the grounds. She needed a crime analyst to start pulling records on everyone who had access to Sarah's apartment. All hands on deck, she thought to herself. Hendershot was raised in the sprawling middle-class suburbs northwest of Denver. She spent her childhood in Arvada, a close-in suburb of 100,000. Her mother taught music at local elementary schools and played piano and organ for the Presbyterian Church. Her father worked in Colorado State Assembly Building in Denver and got involved in local politics. She was the middle kid, sandwiched between an older and younger brother. Her parents did their best to make her ladylike. Her mother enrolled her in ballet classes and tried to teach her piano. The pair made regular trips to an arts center just blocks from home. None of it stuck. I would go into the living room where the piano was, and my nice mom would be sitting there at the piano, wanting me to play the piano. I would just be horrible to her. I know I was really mean about it, but I hated it. I wanted to be outside, running around and playing with my friends. I didn't want to play the dumb piano. Hendershot was the classic tomboy. She loved sports. She was a swimmer. She excelled at soccer. At a time when girls' athletics was just taking off, Hendershot was already traveling across Colorado on competitive club teams. She competed in high school as starting goalie for Arvada High. Hendershot could never say exactly what drew her to police work. She didn't have close family who were cops or criminals, the common motivators for many in law enforcement. It was something that was meant to be. I don't have a storybook answer, she'd tell people. I just always knew that it was what I was supposed to do. Her career path wasn't straight. After graduating from high school in 1988, she studied criminal justice at two colleges. But money was tight, so she started working and going to school part-time. She manned the register at a Wendy's. She bussed tables and worked as a waitress for $2.50 an hour and tips at a local Mexican restaurant. But she was determined to become a cop. In 1990, she got a job as a records clerk at the Adams County Sheriff's Office, reviewing inmate files from the local jail. A year later, she quit that job to start handling emergency calls as a 911 dispatcher for the Arvada Police Department. She worked nights and took classes during the day, paying her own way through police academy. When she graduated, she didn't stray from home. Westminster, the town next to Arvada, hired her as a patrol officer. She was sworn in on September 19, 1994. Westminster often gets called a bedroom community of Denver, and in some ways it is, a mostly middle-class, mostly white town of 100,000. Knots of parents cluster each weekend on the sidelines of kids' soccer matches. Big box stores bunch together at major intersections. Ranch-style houses and apartment complexes sprawl in every direction around the Denver-Boulder Turnpike, which serves as the city's spine. But like many inner suburbs, Westminster defies saccharine characterization. Gangs and drugs plague the neighborhoods that bump against Denver. There was plenty of crime for a young cop who wanted to make a mark. After 5 years on the street, Endershot beat out competitors for a spot on the West Metro Drug Task Force. The elite unit drew cops from around the region to crack down on narcotics and gangs. She was the only woman on the squad. The other cops took to calling her Ed. Endershot learned that her gender could be a kind of superpower. Both colleagues and criminals found her looks striking. When her supervisors were stumped on how to get close to a drug dealer, she'd volunteer for the job. This sounds arrogant, but they would say, "Who can get to this guy?" I'd say, "I can probably do it." It's disgusting what you can get with a hair flip and a giggle. She was good at working undercover. She could be the dumb blonde, or the hot biker chick, or the stressed-out mother in the middle of a custody dispute. When suspects asked her to do a line or to take off her clothes, she had an excuse. "I'll go home and I'll get beat up," she'd say. Or, "I've got court tomorrow with social services. I can't be high." Once, she worked a case involving a crooked deputy who was smuggling drugs and weapons to gang members in jail. Endershot worked her way into the suspect's confidence by befriending a gang member who made introductions. After the dirty cop was arrested, Endershot showed up on scene. The gang member, hardened, streetwise, was there too, in handcuffs. He refused to believe that Endershot was really a cop. "I took a lot of pride in that," she says. "I was able to be so believable that he bought it." Endershot racked up praise. She was selected to serve as a field training officer, a position of trust where she mentored young officers. For 12 years straight, when Hendershot's bosses filled out her performance evaluation, they gave her the highest possible mark for teamwork, exceptional. By 2007, things were changing in Hendershot's personal life. She got married again. Her first marriage had ended in divorce years before. Her new husband was Mike Endershot, who had been a police sergeant in Golden and later became a commander at another agency in the Denver suburbs. He proposed to her under the Eiffel Tower. They had found a house big enough for their dog and two cats and moved in together. Endershot decided to move out of undercover work. She had spent enough time on the squad that criminals might start to recognize her. But she was nervous about a new assignment. She wondered whether she'd ever be as good at anything else. "Okay, great. Now what?" she thought to herself. "I peaked before I'm 40. Yay!" Her new post was in the Crimes Against Persons division. Here, suddenly, was a new world. Her victims were people who had been injured, raped, or killed. When she filled out paperwork as a narcotics cop, the victim was the state of Colorado or the United States of America. Now she wrote down someone's name, someone with whom she had sat and talked, someone whose pain she had seen firsthand, someone whose death had sent a family reeling. It was a little overwhelming. I literally had a physical reaction to that. Holy shit. This is a big deal. They are 100% depending on you. It's all you. After finishing the interview at the hospital, Hendershot drove to Sarah's apartment on the city's west side. It was 10 a.m., already hot. The buildings in the apartment complex were 3 stories tall, with orange panels and brick facades. They shared a pool, a clubhouse, and a trail. The renters were blue-collar, health aides, cable installers, fast food workers. Outside the apartment, Hendershot met Officer Chris Pyler, who had spent the morning tracking down witnesses. He had spoken with the neighbors who called the police after Sarah banged on their door for help. They, too, were new to the complex. They had listened to Sarah recount the details of the rape. The wife had trouble believing all of them. For instance, Sarah told the neighbors that the rapist had made her wash her hair, but Sarah's hair had been dry. The wife also thought Sarah made odd remarks. Sarah had told them, "Oh, you just moved in here. This is the last thing you need." The wife didn't think that Sarah was lying, necessarily. She just thought she was behaving strangely. "It's not what I would have done," the wife told Pyler. The woman's skepticism was not surprising. When it came to rape, victims frequently encountered doubt. From police, yes, but also from family and friends. There was a sense, both in police departments and among the general public, that not all reports of rape were true. The problem was, no one knew just how many. Criminologists had spent decades trying to determine how many women lie when they report being raped. The answers were all over the map. A police surgeon in England concluded in a 2006 report that 90% of rape allegations were false, a widely criticized figure based on a tiny sample of 18 cases. The feminist Susan Brown Miller, whose groundbreaking work, Against Our Will, Men, Women, and Rape, influenced a generation of activists, pegged the number at 2%, though that figure too had been sharply questioned. Researchers who specialized in sexual assault had settled on a range. Somewhere between 2% and 8% of rape allegations were false. But this range was tied to a specific definition. It only counted those rape allegations where police could prove a woman had knowingly lied. In reality, that didn't happen very often. Cops simply dropped cases where they had doubts, conducting no further investigation. The true percentage of false reports proved elusive, obscured by advocacy, different definitions of sexual assault, and the near impossibility of extracting concrete data from a crime shrouded in shame and secrecy. For her own work, Hendershot needed what she called definitive evidence before dismissing a sexual assault allegation as false. There was this guy who had come to an emergency room with a mutilated testicle. It was so badly cut up that doctors had to remove it. The man told the doctors that he had been attacked with a knife and raped. Hendershot spent weeks running down the leads that the man supplied, even driving to Wyoming to search for evidence. But then she found that the man was part of an online pornographic chat room where people engaged in genital mutilation. Hendershot charged him with filing a false report to police, but only after she watched a video of the man maiming himself with a razor and an elastic band usually used to neuter cattle. In other words, she set the bar high. After talking with Pyler, Hendershot walked into the apartment to check out the crime scene. She was relieved to see an old friend, Catherine Ellis, one of the senior crime scene investigators for the Westminster Police Department. Ellis had been on scene since 7:38 a.m., rushing out after she heard about the rape on a police radio installed in the department's crime laboratory. The two had met years before, when both worked as dispatchers at a nearby police department. They had advanced upward through their careers together. Ellis's path led her into crime scene investigations long before the field became popular on television. "I was CSI before there was CSI," she would joke. Over the years, she had built a reputation for thoroughness. She took training courses at the elite FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia. She had an eidetic memory. Years later, she could recall the case number of a criminal report by heart. She was a realist about her job. "It's not glamorous," she'd say. "It's dumpsters and dismembered children and crawl spaces." By the time Hendershot arrived, Ellis had already walked through the apartment room by room. Her notes reflected her obsession with capturing every detail of a crime scene. "Unit is a two-bedroom, two-bathroom apartment with a kitchen, dining area, and living room. The entryway opens into the living room. The living room was located on the south side of the apartment. It was furnished with a piano against the east wall, a leather sofa along the south wall, a round coffee table in front of the sofa, a round end table on the west side of the sofa, and a rocker glider. The sofa had a stack of newspapers and a folder for restaurant and grocery coupons on the west cushion, an indentation that could be a foot impression on the middle cushion, and a Bible and prayer book open on the east cushion. Over 5 hours in the apartment, Ellis dusted for fingerprints on the windowsills, doors, and counters. She deployed cotton swabs across surfaces throughout the home, the living room window, the mattress topper, the bathroom sink, and toilet. She took hundreds of photos of the disarray in the master bedroom, the living room, the back porch. She checked the apartment's two outside doors and windows for signs of forced entry. She bagged up evidence, the pale green flat sheets that the rapist had left behind, purple kitchen gloves found near the sink, a red, orange, and white comforter. She used a special lamp to check the mattress topper for genetic material. Hendershot told Ellis about the rapist picking up the white sunbeam timer from Sarah's kitchen. When Ellis got to the bathroom, she found it perched on the edge of the vanity. It was one item in the apartment that she knew the rapist had touched. She collected it as evidence to check for the presence of DNA. Ellis assumed that a crime occurred as the victim recounted it, but as she examined a scene, she focused on the evidence, whether contradictory or confirmatory. Her job, as she saw it, was to uncover the truth, whatever it was. "We report what the evidence shows us, not what you're telling us. You want evidence to scream, liar, liar, not you." So far, though, Ellis had not found much evidence of anything in Sarah's apartment. She noted that a screen had fallen to the ground under a window near the back door, but that could have happened at any time. On the couch, under a window, there was the depression that looked as if it could have been made by someone stepping on a cushion. But she had found no indication of forced entry, no pry marks on any of the door frames, no broken window panes. She discovered no fingerprints on the windowsills, or couch, or in the bedroom. Illuminating the apartment had revealed only a small amount of body fluids restricted to the bed. One thing, however, did stand out. On the railing surrounding the back porch, Ellis noticed strange impressions, a row of small hexagonal marks, like a honeycomb, she thought. She took pictures to make sure they were preserved. But she was not certain what could have caused them. Maybe a mover's blanket tossed over the railing? What a weird pattern, she thought to herself. 2 days after the rape, Hendershot met Sarah at the Westminster police station. They sat across from each other in an interview room, a desk between them. Hendershot turned on her tape recorder. She hoped enough time had passed to allow Sarah to recall additional details. She started slow. What was Sarah's life like in the days and months before the rape? Sarah told her story. She had divorced late in life, after decades in a loveless, angry marriage. I just decided I wasn't going to live like that any longer, she said. She found new love with a man 20 years her senior. He had a large family. She had no children. They attended church together. She sang in the choir. They spent nights out at Denny's. They married in October 2009 and moved into an apartment big enough for two. Then he was diagnosed with cancer. 8 weeks after her wedding, Sarah buried her husband. Her decision to move into a smaller apartment at a new complex was the first step toward acknowledging the reality of widowhood. She signed the lease on July 28, 2010. The rapist had struck 13 days later. And what about the rape? Hendershot asked. We talked about how you were ready for bed, and you went to bed about midnight. And then what do you remember happening next?
I just remember, there was someone on top of me. I was on my back. I mean, I was on my stomach. I was on my stomach, Sarah said. She stopped, flustered. Do we have to go through the whole sequence again?
Hendershot understood. She had worked more than 100 rape cases. She knew how difficult it was to talk about rape, so difficult that it stopped many women from reporting at all. One of the top reasons was the fear of not being believed. Younger cops were often puzzled. You want to catch the guy? Why not spill the details? Hendershot had a standard comeback. Tell me about the last time you and your wife had sex. Tell me right now, she'd say. Those who didn't let out an embarrassed laugh reacted with shocked silence. They got the message. In the interview room, Sarah went over the basics again, but she added new details. For instance, she remembered that the attacker had placed thigh-high stockings on her legs. But she couldn't recall their color or where they came from. How did they get on you? Hendershot asked. Sarah could not describe how. And how come you don't see them? Hendershot asked.
I think I was on my stomach.
Sarah remembered, too, that the rapist had asked whether she had high heels. When she told him no, he came back from her closet with a pair of her own shoes.
I had this image of what they might have been, but I'm still not sure, she said.
She did not know what pair of shoes he had grabbed, nor if he had taken them when he left. Hendershot was not discouraged. She kept probing. She tried to get Sarah to give her a better description.
What about by his eyes? Do you remember anything by his eyes?
I certainly don't remember anything, really, about his face. I really don't.
Okay. So, no eye color?
I couldn't tell.
Any facial hair?
Sarah shook her head no. I could not tell you. I can't. If Sarah's visual memory was lacking, her oral recollections were precise. She knew that the rapist carried a gym bag because she remembered the noise of zipping. She knew he had gone to the bathroom because she heard him urinating. She couldn't describe the camera he had used, even though he had pointed it directly at her.
All she could remember was the sound. Click, click, click.
But more often, Sarah's story rambled, a jumble of moments and memories, unordered by time. She would struggle to piece together the sequence of events. She told Hendershot that she knew the time that the rapist left because she had seen some little girls playing outside her apartment. She thought for a moment. She had called the cops at around 7 a.m. Why would children be outside at that hour?
No, that doesn't make sense, she said, almost to herself.
Sarah grew frustrated at the lacunae of her story.
You know, most of the time, my eyes were closed, she told Hendershot. Part of the time, 'cause he was forcing me. Part of the time, I just didn't even want to look.
Hendershot reassured her, if you don't remember, that's okay. Sarah's fractured world did not alarm Hendershot. She had learned that people who got hurt in traumatic events often had altered memories. Many could no longer recall events in chronological order. Trauma can warp the brain. A car accident, a tree falling close by, seeing your buddy shot on the battlefield. In those terrifying seconds, the rush of adrenaline and cortisol created a violent alchemy. The mind became an uncertain eyewitness of its own experience. Events were unlinked from the time when they occurred. Memories got buried. Images could arise days, months, even years later, unwanted and unbidden, picture perfect in clarity, like a landscape suddenly illuminated by lightning. Rape was a special case. The experience of rape, the feeling of helplessness, impaired memories in ways that seemed almost designed to frustrate investigators. To endure the terrible present of violation, many women looked away from what was happening to them, looked away from their attacker. They focused on a lampshade or a painting on the wall, or they closed their eyes. That meant women could often not describe the rapist, or what he wore, or the room, the time, the surroundings. Psychologists have documented the role that a powerful, central detail can play in the formation of memories. At a moment of crisis, the brain fiercely grasps on to something that will help it survive. In some cases, this is the actual threat. Like when a cop can describe a weapon pointed at him in extraordinary detail, but has trouble recalling the clothing a suspect wore. In other cases, though, the salient detail is not the immediate threat. Indeed, it can be something not tied to the anguish of the rape at all, say, a lamp on a nearby nightstand or a streetlight in the distance. By fixing on such a detail, the mind can shift away from the immediate horror to a cognitively safer place. Rebecca Campbell, a leading researcher of sexual assault at Michigan State University, says that victims often describe their experience of rape using the metaphor of a jigsaw puzzle. When solving a puzzle, the first thing most people do is flip all the pieces right side up. Next, they sort them into edge pieces, corner pieces, and body pieces. Then, they look at the picture on the box to figure out how to put the pieces together. But rape victims have no way to solve the puzzle. They don't have all the pieces. They can't sort them in any meaningful way. And who can stand to gaze at such an awful picture if they can even form the image? A trauma memory doesn't come together in a nice, neat, orderly memory, says Campbell, who studies trauma's effects on the brain. It is scattered throughout the brain, literally. It was Hendershot's job to help Sarah piece together the puzzle. But at the end of the interview, she felt no closer to connecting a suspect to the crime. The rapist was smart.
He had given away few clues to his identity.
As they wrapped up the interview, Hendershot decided to give Sarah some good news. The $200 was gone, but in the apartment, the cops had found the camera Sarah believed had been stolen. Perhaps she had just overlooked it when she surveyed her belongings after the rape.
But there were two cameras, Sarah said.
There were two cameras? What do you mean? Hendershot asked. She had thought there was only one in Sarah's place.
Well, there was a pink Sony, and then there was a bigger camera, mostly silver.
The cops had found the silver camera, Hendershot knew. Where was the pink Sony? She dispatched police to Westminster's pawn shops to look for any reports of somebody hawking a pink camera. There were none. Hendershot was setting up an interview with a Comcast cable guy who had serviced Sarah's apartment complex when she got a call. It was a police sergeant from Aurora, a wealthier suburb 30 miles to the southeast of Westminster. Through chatter among cops, the sergeant had learned details about the rape in Westminster. One of her detectives had a similar case, she told Hendershot. Perhaps they should compare notes. Hendershot had just caught her first break. 2 weeks after Sarah's rape, Hendershot sat down in a small conference room at the Westminster Police Department. Across from her was Scott Burgess, a detective from Aurora. Burgess had salt and pepper hair. He wore a long-sleeved shirt, pressed slacks, and a tie to work. He was a precise, careful man. On some days, he looped his tie once, twice, three, four times into an Eldridge knot. It was one of the hardest knots to tie. Ties.com gave it 5 out of 5 for difficulty. Aurora's police department had created a specialized sex crimes unit 5 years earlier. Burgess was one of its pioneers. I was so lucky to get that draw, he says. Like Hendershot, he loved the idea of helping other people, and Burgess understood victims. One thing I learned is that there is no right way for a victim to respond to these assaults. I've had victims bring me to tears in an interview where you find out later that they're false reports. I've also had victims that I would think to myself afterward, there's no way that this happened. You don't come across like that after something so heinous. The thing I learned is there is no proper response. The lesson served him well when he had responded to the rape in Aurora in October 2009. The victim was a woman named Doris, a 65-year-old divorcee who worked as a house mother at a local fraternity. She had been raped at her home in a neighborhood in South Aurora. When Burgess interviewed her the following day, Doris seemed composed, he told Hendershot. She had a very matter-of-fact demeanor, was not emotional. I don't recall any sort of an outpouring or a breaking down, he said. It was just, this happened. Now let's see what we can do. With Hendershot listening, Burgess reviewed the bullet points in his report. The victim was home sleeping on a Sunday morning at approximately 2:30 a.m. The suspect opened the door, straddled her back, and shined a flashlight on her. The suspect directed her to roll over onto her back. She saw that his face was covered with a black mask or wrap that had a slit for his eyes. The suspect was a white male, approximately 20 years old, 6 feet tall, big-boned and strong, without being muscular. He had light-colored or no body hair and was soft-spoken. The suspect told the victim, "I'm not going to hurt you, but I am going to rape you." The suspect tied her hands together in front of her. The suspect used a ribbon that was loosely tied. The suspect had a large black backpack. The suspect assaulted her repeatedly.
The suspect took pictures of her and threatened to post them on the internet if she called the police. Afterward, the suspect dressed and stated that he was going to take the sheets. In the end, she was made to shower as he stood in the bathroom and directed her on how to wash. He told her to wait 20 minutes before getting out. Doris had described the rapist as nice and gentle. During the attack, she had told him that she was 65 years old, too old to rape. "That's not old," the rapist had responded. Doris told Burgess that just before the man began to rape her, he removed the pink curlers from her hair. "I know I'm going to feel bad about this later, but I can't help it," he had told her. "You should get help," Doris told him. "It's too late for that," he replied. Doris said she tried to be sympathetic. He was still young. Maybe he had been abused as a child. It was not too late to change. The man slapped down the idea. He had never been abused. His parents were loving. He didn't smoke, drink, or do any drugs. "If they knew what I did, it would kill them," he told her. He had to rape. It was a compulsion, he told Doris. He had been fighting it a long time. He had lost again and again. "I can't help this," he said. Doris told Burgess that the man had begun to fill the bathtub with water after he ordered her into the bathroom. For a brief second, she imagined the worst. "I immediately thought he was going to drown me," she said. Instead, he told her to wash herself off. "Give me 20 minutes, because I want to be thorough," he told her. When she got out, the clock said 3:45 a.m. She was too scared to call the police. She dressed. She made herself a cup of coffee. She sat down at her computer. She browsed the internet. Finally, at 6 a.m., Doris noticed that she was bleeding from her vagina. She drove herself to an emergency clinic. They told her to keep driving, directing her to the medical center of Aurora, which had resources for rape victims. There, a nurse called the police. The hospital performed a 3-hour forensic exam to salvage any traces of DNA that might remain on her body. Burgess told Hendershot that he realized the case would be difficult. Doris recalled many details of the rape, but her memories didn't reveal much about the rapist's identity. "How do I even put this out to the department?" Burgess asked himself at the time. "I can't even tell you really, confidently, what racial or ethnic makeup my suspect might be, because everything was covered." He told Hendershot that he imagined the attacker as a kind of rape expert. Ultra-prepared, as he described it. This guy was very meticulous. Burgess's report recounted his efforts. He sent patrol officers to canvass Doris's neighborhood, a cluster of modest homes on a small cul-de-sac off one of Aurora's main east-west thoroughfares. One officer dug through 30 trash cans and 3 portable toilets at a nearby baseball field. Another officer chased down a man seen walking near the crime scene with a weapon, only to find it was a BB gun. When police pulled over a man for speeding near the scene, they discovered a pink sheet, some towels, and 2 black bags in his trunk. The officer retrieved the sheets from Doris's house. They didn't match. For good measure, the officer called the man's girlfriend. She backed up his story, explaining that she left the sheets in his trunk after doing laundry. Burgess's initial suspicion focused on the fraternity house brothers. Doris didn't think so. "It's not one of my guys," she told him, saying that she would recognize the voice. Burgess, however, contacted the police who patrolled the campus to see if they had recorded any similar assaults. A police sergeant directed him to a single case involving a student who was 6 feet one and weighed 160 pounds. Police had stopped him for behaving strangely in November 2008. In the trunk of his car, they found police-style equipment, a flashing light that could be mounted on top of a vehicle, a baton, a breathalyzer, and a 9mm Beretta. But the man had no criminal record. Burgess put the case and his theory aside. Doris had provided a detailed description, but it was a description of a phantom, a masked man dressed in gray. There were no other clues, no eyewitnesses, no video surveillance. On December 31st, 2009, with the year coming to a close, Burgess wrote down the case status in capital letters, inactive. He wasn't closing the case. There was a possibility that some other clue might trickle in. But he knew, inside, what inactive meant. They're not going to go anywhere. It was a crushing conclusion for Burgess. The case haunted him. He considered Doris's rape one of the two or three worst cases he had investigated in his career. He would ask himself why she had been targeted. He was glad he could never reach an answer. "If you understand that, that's a bad thing," he'd say to himself. Burgess left the meeting with Hendershot with new hope. The circumstantial evidence suggested one conclusion. The same person raped both Doris and Sarah. If Hendershot caught a break in her case, maybe he'd catch a break in his. 8 months after archiving Doris's case, Burgess updated the file. The investigation was active again. All it took was one misstep by the rapist. One mistake, two crimes solved. It was simple math. In the weeks after Sarah's rape, Hendershot played coach to a team of detectives, criminalists, crime analysts, and street cops. She had a half dozen cops check every trash can near the apartment in hopes that the rapist had tossed something as he fled. She had them scour the ditches and a retention pond, too. She ran names through Colorado's sex offender registry. The cable guy who had briefly chatted with the victim while setting up her internet, neighbors throughout the apartment complex, even the garbage men. No hits. Leads poured in. One by one, Hendershot knocked them down. Police had arrested Sarah's ex-husband for rape in 1978, but Sarah insisted that she would have recognized her ex, mask or no. Police were investigating another stranger rape in the apartment complex where Sarah had lived with her deceased husband, but the suspect was a Saudi Arabian man who fled the country. One cop called to say he remembered a case from years ago that involved a man who carried a rape toolkit. That guy turned out to be too old. Finally, there was the young man with the black backpack, who had been spotted wandering along a wooded creek less than 2 miles from Sarah's apartment complex. He turned out to be a college student with a green streak. Early one morning, he'd gone to the creek to arrange river rocks to improve circulation in stagnant pools of water. He confessed to showing a little attitude when cops questioned him, but he wasn't a rapist. Hendershot knew that rapes, especially stranger attacks, are usually solved in the first week. Each hour, each day that passed, reduced the chance of catching the attacker. She was running out of leads to chase. Other criminal cases were piling up. The trail was growing cold. By December 2010, Hendershot was feeling deja vu. She was in the same spot Burgess had been in a year earlier. Actually, it was a worse spot, because now the detectives had reason to believe that a serial rapist was on the loose. One who had raped two women for several hours, but managed to leave behind no real clothes, no eyewitnesses, no description, no fingerprints, and not enough DNA to enter into any database. What's more, both Hendershot and Burgess believed that the rapist would